Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Triple Click Home.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Triple Click Home, where we explore all things Apple, Macintosh, iOS, iPhone, and Mac computers. I'm Buddy Brannon.
And I'm Peter Bosley.
And I'm Alina Roberts.
Let's start off with the news. Do you have the news?
I do. So let's start by talking about our latest news from Apple, which is that Mountain Lion is going to be coming out this summer, and developers already have had a chance to look at it.
They're saying it's sort of an incremental upgrade from Lion, sort of like Snow Leopard was from Leopard. And one article I saw said something like, yeah, Apple still can surprise people. And that's kind of interesting because, well, historically, if you can call 5 or so years historical. But anyway, historically, operating system major upgrades have been on an 18-month release cycle, say between Tiger and Leopard, Leopard to Snow Leopard, and so forth. This year, they've lopped off about 6 months, and now it looks like just 1 year after Lion, we're getting Mountain Lion.
I think Apple has a growth issue. They are so popular, and they are finding themselves so scattered in the product lines that they have that they are now trying to kind of bring them together. And I was frankly surprised to see that Lion didn't have more of the iOS feel than it did. So I think that the release of Mountain Lion is going to really kind of bring these disparate parts together.
Oh, so the features that we know about so far is that they really are going to bring the iOS features into your Mac. So iMessages is actually already out in beta for those of you that are Mac users. It's the same app that you have on your iPhone, and you can send iMessages to people on iPhones and Macs through your Mac. I haven't tested it myself, but people are pretty happy with it that I've seen on Twitter. The other features that you're going to see are notifications, just like your notifications app on your iPhone or iOS device. And then there are a couple things that aren't iOS related. And maybe you want to talk a little bit about those, Peter. I know that you had some feelings on the new security feature. And I'm going to put that in quote marks. Feature, yes.
So there's a new setting in Mountain Lion that is dubbed a security feature, and it sure could be argued as a security feature, but I believe that it speaks to some things that may be coming down the pipes later. So essentially, this feature or security measure or what have you allows the user or presumably a system administrator to define different trust levels for applications. There are three settings. One is to allow only Mac App Store applications to be installed on the machine. The next setting allows Mac App Store applications and also applications that are signed by Mac developers in the Apple developer program. And the third setting is what we now currently have on our Macs, which is any application can be installed from the web or from the store, regardless of whether it's been signed by an actual developer on the Mac developer program. As a person who works on applications and as a consumer of the Mac platform, I find this to be somewhat of a troubling trend. While I am a security professional by day and I do see the advantages to having the option to change the trust level, I think that there's a mistake in allowing Apple to set this by default the way they have. I think that they're testing the waters for restricting application installs to anything that's approved on the App Store only. And as we've seen with recent events, nudge, nudge with Accessible Event, there are times where applications that have value are rejected from the Mac App Store for a myriad of technical and business reasons. And while I support Apple's right to choose what is distributed through their store, I think that as a consumer of the platform, we should all be kind of concerned that we may eventually have a situation where our Macs are like our iOS devices and we don't have any choice.
Yeah, well, it's sort of one of those good news, bad news kinds of things. Good news is that they're going to make everything look and feel very similar. And that's a trend that's been starting really since the iPhone 4 and so forth. Of course, the downside of that is that everything's going to look and feel the same, which could certainly mean that we're going to be faced with more restriction. And it sort of speaks to Apple's policy, I guess, of controlling every aspect of the user experience. So what's that going to mean for the Mac? Are we going to see the Mac looking just like iOS in the fact of only being able to run Apple approved or Apple sanctioned apps? And with that second level of security being sort of a compromise between fully open and fully locked down. And I guess also you have to decide here, how much do you trust Apple to have your best interest at heart for security and that sort of thing?
I think it's a difficult argument because on the one hand, I see both sides. I see the side that says, as Macs continue to gain popularity and as people continue to buy them, the risk of malware and viruses being written for the Apple platform is going to increase. The reason why viruses are so prevalent on Windows is because of how many people own them, right? It's something that hackers know that there's a lot of people that they can get to when they put out that virus. And Macs are continuing to grow in the computer world, but they're still nowhere near the level of a PC. And so on the one hand, I see Apple's reasoning of let's make sure that people are only downloading apps that have gone through our stringent restrictions. But on the other hand, I think it all has to be user common sense. You have to decide for yourself as a user, is something too good to be true? Or am I going to take the risk? And if you take the risk and you end up hurting your computer, then, you know, Apple can say, well, see, I told you so. But I think I'm with Peter in that I want to be able to have that choice. I want to be able to, as the user, still have the option on my Mac to download something that isn't from the App Store.
I got quite a bit of flack on Twitter for my stance on this particular issue. And to address some of the things that I heard, many people said to me, well, hey, you know, the user can change a setting, which is fine.
For this version.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
If this is the worst that it gets, then, okay, we can say that's probably not a big deal. The other thing that a lot of people seemed to miss was that the setting to allow Mac developers' applications to be installed as well as App Store applications. They said, well, anybody can become a Mac developer. And I take contention with that because the truth of the matter is not everybody can become a Mac developer. There is a acceptance process that you must go through.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple is the one generating the certificates that are signing your applications. And Apple
right.
can decide to revoke the certificates. The same situation does not exist on Windows. Code signing mm-hmm. certificates on Windows are generated by a variety of third parties. And Microsoft would have to have the issuing authority to issue your certificate, revoke your certificate in order for your code signing certificate to become invalid. And past that point, even on Windows at its default behavior, the system will still prompt you whether you want to run or install an unsigned application. So the comparison of this new feature to user account control is not an apples to apples comparison, pun intended.
Yeah, and again, how much should we trust Apple to hold sort of the keys to all of the security, really? And we'll probably be addressing this more in an upcoming and a story later in this podcast about apps having access to things they probably shouldn't have access to. But we'll be getting to that in a little while.
But the good news is that for all ye Mac users that really like having the new latest and greatest, if you like the things that you have in iOS 5, if you're an iOS device user and you want those features in your Mac, they're coming. Siri, however, is not.
Nope, no Siri yet.
If that's something that you guys were hoping for, that's not going to be in Mountain Lion. I think there's actually a lot of probably legitimate reasons for that, but maybe someday.
I don't know. I don't know that we'll have Siri on the desktop. Well, maybe, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either, because I think there's a lot of technical issues that you might have to get around.
I actually think we will see Siri eventually, but I think it'll be when Apple does some new hardware as far as microphones go.
Yeah, for sure. So our next piece of news is that Apple has sold more iOS devices than it's sold Macs in the last 28 years. That's pretty huge. I know that when the iPod first came out, I thought to myself, maybe this is going to be the answer to Apple's problems, which was that, you know, they were still a floundering company. There were a lot of people like me who really loved Macs and were willing to stick with them, but they weren't as popular as they could be. And then they came out with the iPhone, and it's just been huge. They are actually the most profitable company, one of the most profitable companies in the whole entire world. They're worth more than Google and Microsoft combined.
I think we can safely say that Apple is no longer a cult.
No. or it's the biggest cult ever.
Or it's the biggest cult ever, yes.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to kind of see a metric like that, because you think of the iPhone and you think of the iPad and you intellectually know that there are a lot of them out there. And then you look at the sales numbers and how much of Apple's revenue and their profit is centered on iOS devices, and the amount is just staggering. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that it's eclipsed Mac sales by so far really isn't shocking, but the scale kind of is. Yeah.
Scale definitely is, and I don't know, it's kind of interesting. I think this just came to mind. I think Apple must have seen the writing on the wall some time ago. As you'll recall, a couple of WWDCs ago, I believe it was the 2009 one when the 3GS came out, although it might have been 2010. One of those basically went pretty much all iPhone and really cheesed off a bunch of Mac developers. Y'all remember that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Apple had seen the writing on the wall, and they were starting to bet on the iPhone, and looks like it paid off.
I also, along that note, there are almost, unless the counter already went over the top, 25 billion app downloads, which is another staggering number in my head.
Well, you know, we have people in the SamNet community who I will not name to protect their guilt that have multi-hundreds of applications on their devices.
Wow.
So if you think about that possibility, then there are quite a few apps that could be floating around downloaded out there.
So let's see. You can have 12 pages of apps, 12 apps to a folder. That's
Oh, gosh, I can't do that math in my head.
I can't do it.
Now you got me trying to do the math in my head, and I hate math. Because then you got to calculate the folders that you can put on the dock, too.
Yeah.
I didn't even... Oh, yeah.
Then you got to subtract one because newsstand won't go
right
in a folder.
even though us voice users really wish that it would.
Yes, we do. And you can't put other apps in that folder either, because I've tried.
So, Peter, you want to talk to us a little bit about Apple's response to the contact data sharing?
I thought the response was lame.
So I don't know how many of you have heard about this new service called Path, but it's kind of a, what do we call it, a hybrid journal / social network startup. And their big claim to fame is, you know, we're not Facebook and we're not Twitter and we're not Google+. We care about your privacy. And then someone probably, when they had way too much time on their hands, sniffed the traffic that was being sent from their iOS device when they launched Path. And realized that, lo and behold, Path was copying your address book off of your iPhone, mm-hmm, or iPad or whatever device we're talking about. And doing so without asking permission or without really spelling out to you right then and there what was happening. They did have it in their terms of service, but as we've previously discussed, not very many people actually read through all of that. So
it was in paragraph 48.
Right, subsection D, G, 3.
And it was probably in some verbiage that people wouldn't have understood anyway.
So people were upset, to say the least. A company that starts up on the premise of privacy, 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 Can't be seen to do that. To their credit, they did get out in front of it very quickly. They said, we are releasing an application update to remedy the problem. We'll ask for your permission. And they took the sensible step of deleting all of the data that they had collected without permission.
Good.
Which was classy of them. Not very many companies would have so forthrightly done that. So, Path, I applaud you for your decision. You better not do anything like that again. You probably get one time where your honesty will work in your favor, and then from then on, you better be clean as the peer-driven snow.
And that goes for any company. It's one thing.
Yeah, it does.
It's one thing for me to have them track my own data. It's a whole nother thing for them to have access to my address book, and that's people's phone numbers and people's email addresses that they have no business seeing and no business using.
And, you know, in their defense, their usage of it seems pretty benign.
Okay.
They copy your data in order to connect you with your friends and family. And, so, you know, you have to read their privacy policy and evaluate whether you trust them to store the data and use it as they said that they have. You know, they're no different than having your address book stored on Google or Hotmail or anything like that. Don't think that those companies wouldn't be free to use that data like that either. So just everybody be aware. The other thing was that Apple's response to this was interesting. They said that it's a violation of their terms of service and that, you know, they're looking into the situation. And having a passing familiarity with the Apple developer agreement, it is actually stated in there that if you are going to copy someone's pictures or their address book or use any of the approved APIs to get data off their device of a personal nature, you have to spell that out either in the application or, you know, as part of the sign-up process, et cetera, et cetera. So they apparently were not quite explicit enough with that setup, and Apple basically said, well, they violated developer agreement, which is definitely true, but they're not the only ones, and we can name names. Twitter, others are just as guilty. So,
well, yeah, so Apple's saying, oh, yeah, they violated our terms of service, and we're going to fix it in an upcoming release. Well, okay, so what does that do to fix the problem now with apps that are out there collecting, potentially collecting this data?
Now, you guys won't hear this very often from me, so you can savor the moment. On this approach, I actually believe that the folks over at Google got it right. When you install an application on Android, there is a dialogue that pops up and gives you a technical enumeration of the data that that application is requesting access to.
Oh, nice.
And so I do believe that Google has made that implementation correctly, and I think that Apple, despite their desire to keep their user experience simple and easy to navigate, will eventually have to move to a model that's closer to the Android side of the pond than the current setup. Either that, or they're going to have to spend more time evaluating each one of these apps and tightening up the review process.
So I actually agree with you, and let's see, today is February the 21st at approximately 8:30. Take note. Praising something that Google is doing correctly is probably a rare occurrence for Mr. Bosley.
and to also counterbalance that, don't think that any of the Google applications have any hesitation in harvesting your address book data either.
Oh,
no. Nope. So let's move on to what we're going to call the rumor mill, because we know that Apple is tentatively going to have an event on March 7th, which we are going to posit that they will be announcing the iPad 3.
Which is in keeping with the past couple of iPad releases.
Correct. And there, of course, are all kinds of rumors on what the iPad 3 is going to and not going to come with. And some of them might turn out to be true and some of them won't.
It's very interesting. I sent this link to our inside sales representative at Apple. And I said to him in my email, I said, hey, you know, I say that we have a sit-down meeting on the afternoon of this day because, you know, I was basically probing him to see what he would say, and he writes me back with the winky face on the top of his email, and he says, you don't really expect me to actually answer this, do you?
Nope, they got those boys and gals trained. You don't say a word.
The one rumor that I'm really having trouble believing is the 8-inch iPad rumor.
I don't believe it for a second.
But I'm kind of thinking now. I mean, that rumor came out last year too, and
it's not true.
No, clearly not. Apple's all about like big, beautiful visual experience, and they don't. Yeah. I don't think there's anything in it for them to make a smaller one.
You know, they've got this new Amazon Kindle Fire,
which is inaccessible,
and which is inaccessible. Yes, but the Kindle Fire is.
Have we forgotten so soon?
Three Kindle Fires equals one iPad, and that's of course their big selling point. I think there's rumors going around that Apple's going to respond to this and actually come out with a smaller, cheaper iPad. And that, to me, would go against everything that is Apple.
Apple has never competed on price, ever.
They've never had to.
But think about the people that are saying this stuff, though. I mean, you've got analysts who pretty much never know what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got pundits all over the place, people who think they know way more than they do on the internet speculating about stuff.
Yeah.
You've got fly-by-night bloggers saying, oh, well, I know this about that. And rarely do they know anything. And if they do, it's probably because they had a lucky guess rather than they actually had any inside information.
Well, come on, my cousins, uncles, husbands, aunts, roommates, insurance salesman's buddy down the road had dinner with an Apple guy, and he said.
But see, here's the real thing. If you want to make an educated guess about Apple, you can look at what Apple's done in the past, and as you guys said, you know that's not Apple's MO. Oh my goodness, Amazon put out a 7-inch tablet, so we better... Oh wait, but it's not a tablet, it's a beefed up...
Kindle.
Book reader.
Thing.
Yep. And the reality is that the Kindle and the Nook and those tablets are, in my opinion, not competitors to the iPad. And if I was in Apple's position, I wouldn't care if you could buy three Kindle Fires to get an iPad because it's not the same thing.
Three times inaccessible.
Yeah. And it's not accessible, so all of us blind folks don't care anyway. So, last rumor is that we're going to see another iPhone.
There's a shocker.
Because, you know, that never happens.
And it's going to be in the summer or it's going to be in September. Yep. I've seen both.
Yep. And who knows what it's going to come with. And the reality is that the world of Mac rumors is ever exciting to read through.
But we can sit around and make some predictions. And we'll be just about as likely to be right as anyone else.
Sure. You know? I think the only rumor that I really see coming with the new iPhone and possibly the iPad 3 is LTE. Other than that, I don't know. I'm not sure that there's anything all that exciting that we're going to see.
I think we will get LTE.
Yeah.
But who knows?
Yep.
Yeah, we'll find out. We'll find out at the beginning of March, I guess. And it's not that far off.
Motorola Mobile has been purchased by Google. The purchase has been okayed. And is this going to be scary for Apple?
I think it's more scary for any third-party developers or third-party hardware manufacturers that rely on Android than it is for Apple. The landscape is going to be largely unchanged for Apple. They are going to have one major competitor as far as mobile platform goes, and then that platform is going to be pretty well distributed amongst a variety of manufacturers. I think the only thing that Apple really has to worry about here is that Google takes Motorola really under its wing and starts focusing on the handset side of things in a similar vein to Apple. They might have problems then, but frankly, I'm not too worried about that, mainly because I don't really think Google has the wherewithal to actually execute that. And I think that they would face some antitrust complaints if they were to try.
Well, a couple of things. Well, first, Isn't there one more entity that has to approve the merger? It's like
It's not finished. This is the European. Yeah, the European Union has approved.
Yeah,
it.
The EU has China has approved
or somebody
it.
Has to approve
the
it. Still, don't
FTC
they?
FTC has not.
FTC hasn't no, ruled
the
in.
The FTC.
FTC hasn't.
Yeah,
ruled.
The FTC oh, hasn't they? Ruled on it. I think what could be neat though is if they take over Motorola, which is known for the Droid and all of its Android phones, is that they could streamline Android phones to offer people a really great option. And that's not to say that what's out there aren't good options, but I think, I don't know, having a Google hardware phone might be neat.
They could implement all of what they want in Android in a mm-hmm. hardware product without a third-party hardware
exactly.
vendor. Right now, the Google Nexus phones are built by Samsung. I'm really wondering what Google's going to do with Motorola, if for no other reason than because Motorola's release schedule of new Android versions seems to be way behind everybody else's.
Yeah, it does.
I think Motorola's buy was more of a patent grab than anything else.
And I think, in fact, that Google even said somewhere that they pretty much planned to be hands-off as far as the hardware side of the company and so forth, and it was just going to keep running the way it's always been running. Of course, that's what they always say, and you never know what that really means.
Next thing we want to talk about is, does Apple lull its users into a false sense of security? So we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier. I think the reality of the situation is that most Mac and Apple users think that because they own an Apple device, they don't have to worry about viruses, they don't have to worry about malware. Now, even 4 or 5 years ago, I think I could say that with all honesty and be correct.
I don't know.
No.
No?
No.
But I think that's what people think.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. People think that for years now, whenever people post, well, I've got a Mac, I don't have to worry about viruses, I don't have to worry about malware. Well, you still do. Yes, the Mac OS architecture being Unix-based has some more security things just inherent in its architecture, but that doesn't mean that it's foolproof, and it certainly doesn't mean that you're not immune from attack. It's just that the attack has to come through different means.
And, every time someone says that I have a Mac, I don't have to worry about a virus, I am so tempted to own their computer, it's not even funny.
Mm-hmm. Well, and like the article points out, the weakest link is still the user, and Mac users are still subject to social engineering attacks, meaning phishing scams. And by the way, I've noticed within the past couple of months that the artists of these phishing emails have gotten a lot cleverer. Mm. These things look pretty damn legit. A lot of them do anymore. I mean, they've cleaned up the grammar. They've made them look professional. They've even made the headers look pretty convincing. And you have to look really carefully at the headers to determine, no, this isn't what it claims to be. I mean, you have to look really carefully now. Just a year ago, that wasn't the case, but they're wising up.
I appreciate your argument that it really is the end user.
I think Apple shares some responsibility in this because, you know, this is an image that they've perpetuated.
Mm-hmm.
They, as a company, have taught their salespeople to play on the fears of people walking in saying, well, I got so many viruses on my Windows computer, mm-hmm. and instead of telling the user, well, you need to be more careful about what you're doing, they're like, oh, buy
a Mac. Then all of your problems will be solved. No, you're right. I think both Apple and the user have to be responsible. Apple needs to make sure that they're keeping up to date and monitoring security threats and making sure that we have the latest security features on our Macs. But we as users really do have to be sensible. When I talk to people who've gotten viruses and I ask them what happened, you know, there have been situations where my brain just says, really? Really? Are you sure that's what you wanted to do? Because that just sounds like a really dumb thing to me, but I'm not going to tell you that to your face.
Well, here's the thing. The days of, geez, I'm a computer idiot and I don't know anything and all that, those days are over. It's time that we, even the most junior beginning computer user, has to educate We have to educate ourselves because it's all around us, whether we want to admit it or not, whether we want a personal computer in our home or not, whether we intend to be heavy internet users or not. The fact of the matter is that computers in some form, whether it's a personal computer on your desk, a laptop in your briefcase, or a smartphone in your pocket, the fact of the matter is that you can't get away from them. So you better educate yourself and you better understand how to protect yourself and how to and what care you need to exercise in order to safeguard your personal data and your credit card information and your identity and all those other things.
And in Apple's defense, they've really ramped up their security efforts lately. They're a lot better with patches, and their new operating systems get progressively more aggressive about blacklists and things that Apple can update and say, hey, you know, that's a virus. Yep. Don't open this file. So it's not all bad.
No, but
it is worth thinking about.
No, it's not all bad, but you have to definitely be careful and you have to be vigilant.
I've told people on Twitter before that if they don't tell me what the link is for, like explicitly, I'm not opening it. That's just one of my common sense policies. Even if I trust you, if I don't know what this link is, and it really bothers me that all of our links on Twitter are now shortened because I feel like I can't know what I'm getting myself into necessarily. But even if I trust somebody, if you all you do is post a link as a tweet, I'm not clicking on it.
I'm going to start posting only links.
Well,
Alina, do you use Japanese swear word?
I don't.
Because in Japanese swear word, which is like, I guess actually translates as night owl, I have mine set up this way.
Yoru,
I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Oh, okay.
There's an option in the preferences to automatically expand shortened links in,
In
the tweet. So I set that so that I have some kind of idea of where it might be going.
Right.
I don't really like the Twitter shortening.
No.
I'm opposed to their wrapping their links like that. But one advantage that they do have is that since they are wrapping all their links, if someone posts something that links to malware, they can deactivate that link have that link not be valid anymore. So there is a security value in that, even though it kind of makes things pretty annoying.
So next, we are going to talk a little bit about jailbreaking your iPhone 4S.
Yes, nice article on the Serotech blog about that.
Goes through all the steps, and it sounds like it's pretty easy.
It's very easy. I did it.
Okay, all right.
I did it. It's very easy.
I have no reason to jailbreak my iPhone, so I'm going to let all you jailbreakers do your thing.
I don't know, Alina. It is kind of, while it slows down your phone somewhat, it is kind of cool to have the ability to holler at Siri across the room and have her answer you.
You do know that's going to suck the life out of your battery, don't you?
Oh, yes. Yes, it definitely does that.
So if you want to jailbreak your iPhone for us, please visit our show notes and learn how to do it yourself from this great post.
Allison Mervis has a write-up there that she did pretty thorough write-up, too.
Yeah.
I will tell you, everyone, this, that if you jailbreak your device and you need to get it serviced, I think she covers this in the blog post, but you better restore it back to unjailbroken form before you give it to Apple, or they're going to void your warranty.
Yep. Next thing we're going to have in our show notes is talking about a tactile screenshot guide that is available to purchase. So if you're new to the iPhone and you want to get a sense of what is on the screen tactilely, or visually rather, they've created a Braille and print guide that actually shows you screenshots tactily. And that seems pretty cool to me.
I've been using the iPhone now for a couple of years, and I'm thinking about getting this thing.
Really? It seems pointless to me.
Well, I don't know. It could be pretty useful. I mean, it would be at least interesting to verify what I think it looks like. My neighbor up the well, she actually isn't my neighbor up the road anymore because she bought a house in Snootyville, but she just got an iPhone, and this would be great for her along with the companion book that they say it's good to go with, the one by Dean Martineau and Woody Anna Dresner.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I can see the screen a little bit.
Oh, okay. You know, I'm working with a client right now who's having a hard time with the gestures.
Yeah, you know, people seem to have a real problem with the rotor gesture.
Yeah. And along with that, though, I don't think she understands. I've tried to explain to her the visual layout of where the icons are and how touching on a certain part of the screen actually does change what voiceover says. So this might be something that I recommend to her. I think people should look at it. We got an article here that's talking about why the 13-inch MacBook Pro should go away. I, myself, have a white MacBook, which I realize is going to go bye-bye. And I thought about getting the MacBook Pro when I got my 13-inch white one. And decided not to. But I don't think the 13-inch MacBook Pro should go away. What's the argument? That the screen's too small?
No, their argument is that it's too close to the MacBook Air line.
Oh. But it's not.
Let's see, the 13-inch MacBook Air, I think, has a card reader, but doesn't have Ethernet.
It also doesn't have an optical drive. And mm-hmm. while some people seem to think that they can get along without one, there are those of us who cannot.
Right.
And who use the MacBook Pro as a portable desktop replacement.
That's pretty much how I use mine.
Yep.
So the fact that you can't put more than 4 gigs of RAM in the MacBook Air is a problem for some of us.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the reality is all of us blind users who don't turn our screen on don't need to be paying extra money for a bigger screen that we still can't see.
Yeah. Well, there's that.
Not that Apple would think that's a legitimate argument, but I think it is. And I want to throw something in here that just came out yesterday. There is a new app that's being developed at Georgia Tech, and it's going to allow people to type on their iPhones as if they were typing Braille. I think this is a very exciting development. There is a link in the AppleViz forum where you can sign up to be a beta tester when they are ready to have people test the app. It's a lot more like typing Braille than any of the current Braille typing apps that are available on the iPhone. My understanding is that you're actually just using your fingers like you would if you had a Braille keyboard. And I think that's huge because I'm still really slow as a typist.
Me
and
too.
Siri makes a heck of a difference. But if I don't want to talk to Siri when I'm either in a meeting or I'm in a room where I don't really need strangers listening to me talk to my phone, still a little weird about that, then having a Braille keyboard would be awesome.
I guess I don't understand the difference between typing in Braille and typing on the keyboard. I feel like typing in Braille would take me just as long.
But you don't have to find the keys.
I don't have any trouble finding the keys.
Oh. Well, happy day for you, Peter.
I still want Morse code input.
There you go.
Here's the ham radio operator in you coming out.
I could probably Morse faster than I can use the on-screen keyboard.
You would be a true geek if you were to type in Morse code. I imagine that there's an app out there for that. You should go look for that.
There are a couple, but of course they don't replace the keyboard.
So we just want to remind everybody that CSUN is happening next week, the last week of February, rather, and that there will be coverage on SPN radio. And for those of you that are interested in the ATIA interviews from Orlando, those have been posted to the Serotalk website.
That's at www.serotalk.com.
When we come back, we will start our new segment called the Triple Click Quick Tip, and we will also read your mailbag and listen to your eye reports.
Hi, this is John Ondrasik of Five for Fighting, here for RAD, the entertainment industry's voice for road safety. You know, style is a personal thing, and your lifestyle is your business. But if you take it on the road, it becomes everybody's business. So please, plan ahead, designate before you celebrate. Friends, don't let friends drive drunk.
A public service announcement brought to you by RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
So we have a new segment that we're going to be providing to you guys that we're calling the Triple Click Quick Tip. And please don't ask me to say that 5 times fast because I don't think I could do it. We had a question come in that wanted to find out, how do you restore apps when you do an upgrade if something were to go wrong?
What happens sometimes is when you're upgrading from iOS 4 to iOS 5, some people have had a problem where their apps and their folders and their music have all disappeared and didn't get put back on their phone.
By the way, that's because you disconnected your phone after you did the upgrade and didn't leave it connected like iTunes told you to.
Yeah. If, okay. So
Peter,
if you,
I
so
we
if you happened if you happened to do that, which I didn't, mine actually went very smoothly. Basically, what you have to do is you have to go into iTunes and apply changes, and then you have to hit the restore button and restore your iPhone. You'll get an option to restore to an earlier date, and you'd pick an earlier date, and it'll restore your software back from that. There is a link to all the full details of this. There's a nice article on it. We'll link to it in the show notes. If you have questions that you'd like to ask us that may be featured on a future Triple Click Quick Tip, send those to resources@serotalk.com, or you can tweet us at our Twitter address at @TripleClickHome.
Now we're going to move on to items we've received via iReport and our mailbag. Our first iReport is from Lisa Salinger, and she has a comment regarding one of our previous episodes.
Hi, TripleClickHome folks, or TripleClickHomeies, or something. Anyway, this is Lisa Salinger, and I'm leaving an iReport with a thought about the most recent TripleClickHome podcast. One of you said that you felt that only mainstream apps, which were made accessible, should be eligible for nomination into the Apple Viz Hall of Fame. And I'm calling to say I respectfully disagree. And here's why. If you look at, for example, and I know they've taken a lot of heat lately, but they're a good example. If you look at the Blio app, it was minimally accessible and not really functional. I can think of another, at least one game that was designed for the blind, and this was a memory-style game where you had to swipe up, down, left, or right and remember those gestures. It was a Simon sort of style thing. And there was no background music. There was no nothing. It was just this monotone voice saying, swipe left. Swipe down, swipe up. So it was accessible, but it really didn't have a bit of that sparkle. So I think, personally, that accessible apps, wherever they're found, and accessible apps of high quality, should be rewarded, whether they are accessible by accident or designed specifically for that purpose. Thanks for listening.
Well, Lisa, I have to say that respectfully, I am going to hold to my original position, but we certainly appreciate the feedback.
I think she makes an interesting argument, but I think that there, what we might want to consider is having two different categories. So I hold assistive tech companies to the same standard as I do regular companies. And if you, as an adaptive tech company, produce an iPhone app and it's crappy, then I don't think you deserve any credit for that just because you happen to be a company that works for people with disabilities. I think that we all need to strive for excellence, and that is true for accessibility and for the app design itself. Buddy, do you have any opinion?
I don't know. A site that reviews apps for accessibility saying that an accessible app is accessible and that that's wonderful. Well, you say that you hold AT companies to the same standard. I think that we should hold them to a higher standard because accessibility is expected from AT companies.
Agreed.
So I'm with Pete on this one.
That's true.
Hello, everyone. This is Anthony Vesey from Williamstown, New Jersey. And I'm calling in reference to the Triple Click Home podcast. All of you did a very good job with it. I would love to see podcasts on Facebook and Twitter using the most accessible app on the iPhone. That would really be advantageous, I think, for me. And I've seen a few people on the list who would like the same thing. So I hope you would take it under consideration and keep doing a wonderful job. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Anthony.
I'm going to say that from my perspective, as far as Facebook goes, I actually use the Facebook app that the iPhone comes with, or rather, that's native to the iPhone. And I don't have...
Wait, made by
it's
Facebook.
It's made by Facebook.
Right,
it's native
sorry.
To the iPhone.
It's not native to the iPhone. It's made by Facebook. It's not a third-party application that does Facebook feeds. It's not perfect, but I don't have any major issues with it. And as far as Twitter, I use the Twitter app that is made by Twitter. It's got some funky interface issues that I've learned to work around, but it's pretty good, and it does some great push notifications. And then I also use Tweetless Pro, and I find that they're both very easy to use.
I second Alina's comment about Tweetless. Definitely Tweetless Pro is probably my favorite Twitter client on the iPhone. And then I also do use Twitter's native application. As far as Facebook goes, I'm in the same boat as her. I don't use any third-party applications. And I also want to caution those of you that do that the application developer of any of these third-party applications has quite a bit of access to your Facebook account by virtue of you authorizing them to use it on the iPhone. So just be aware and maybe do a little homework on that app developer to make sure that you should really trust them with the ability to read and access and change anything that they wish.
The other Facebook app that I have used is called Facely HD, and I think Facely HD actually just uses the mobile Facebook site, but I've used it. I've used the native Facebook app. The native Facebook app seems to come and go as far as accessibility. They'll have a version that's accessible, and then they'll put out a new one that drops some accessibility, and then they'll fix it again, and so on and so forth. Twitter, yeah, Tweetless Pro, definitely.
The one thing you can expect from Facebook is for it to change.
Yeah, a lot of
don't
people
don't like it too much.
No,
because they're going to take away something that you really like.
Yeah, some people swear by Facebook. I swear at Facebook, so.
Yeah. So let's move on to our mailbag that includes some posts to our Twitter feed. If you want to follow us on Twitter, it's twitter.com/tripleclickhome. We'd love to have you follow us and make comments and give us your feedback. So first thing is a couple of comments from David Nason. He wants to know what is the best way for him to transfer documents he makes in Pages and Keynote from his iPad to his Mac, and is there a way to put documents that he's created in Pages and Keynote on his iPad into Dropbox? So David, what we would recommend is that you plug your iPad into your Mac, go into iTunes, under those applications, there should be an option to take those files off of your iPad and put them onto your Mac. And if people know of a way to use Dropbox on their iPad using Pages and Keynote, please let us know so that we can pass that on to our listeners. Next question we have is from Marcel.
Marcel's asking about Bluetooth headphones and which ones work best with the iPhone.
We are going to request that you go back to Sarah Talk podcast number 92 and listen to the reviews there.
Mike Calvo reviewed several stereo Bluetooth headsets, primarily for music, though. If you're looking for a communications headset that's like a single ear headset, I don't have a recommendation for you. I'm sorry about that. I personally don't have any Bluetooth headsets. I'm too cheap.
And I'm too cheap too.
I break too many of them, so I can't say.
Beth has written in to us to ask about the Digit app that I actually told us about last time. It does have the option of you pairing it with a universal remote. I will tell you honestly that I know nothing about that universal remote and whether or not it's accessible. I know that many universal remotes that are on the market only have a touchpad. I would warn people that before they buy a universal remote that they make sure that it has tactile buttons, because if it doesn't, you're not going to be able to use it. It'll just be a flat panel and it's not going to have any kind of text-to-speech on it.
And if you're talking about remote apps for the iPhone,
yeah,
a lot of those are going to depend on additional hardware.
Right.
Because the remote control is infrared, and of course the iPhone uses either Bluetooth or Wi-Fi, you need an extra piece of hardware to convert the Wi-Fi or Bluetooth signals to infrared that your TV understands. So in any case, if you're looking for something you can control with your iPhone, you're looking at another piece of hardware.
I guess the answer to her question is that we just don't know whether or not you want to buy that particular remote that goes with the app. I can tell you that if you want to find out what TV listings are available, it is still the only application that I have found that is really simple to use and very accessible with VoiceOver. Next is a question from Adam. Adam wants to know, is there any way to automatically close all applications that are running on your iPhone? And we brought this up in one of our previous episodes, and I'm going to let Peter talk a little bit about this.
Yes, I believe it was the last episode, wasn't it?
It was.
I think so, yes. So the way the iOS handles multitasking is somewhat different than what you're used to on the computer. And while you may see a bunch of applications in your application switcher, those applications are, for the vast majority of them, not actually running. So closing those applications will gain you nothing and will lose you time, with a very few exceptions. If you're running a navigation application that seems to be stuck, then you can simply close that using the regular app switcher closing method. But closing all the applications on your device is not a necessary thing. And if you find that your device becomes unresponsive, you can just press and hold the home and sleep buttons together for about 10 seconds, and then your device will do a hard reboot and will come back up and will be in a basically clean state. However, you may still see apps in your app switcher after that that are still in a kind of pseudo-paused state.
So the answer is really, Adam, you don't need to be closing all of them. So no, there is no way for you to close all of them simultaneously. Finally, Pat Pound has asked us to talk a little bit about the accessibility of diagrams and charts and images of some sort on the new iBooks.
The short answer is we don't actually know because we haven't actually seen any of these new iBooks. There is an article on the NFB Technology blog that addresses some of it and basically says that right now iBooks is falling short. There's some speculation that this may not be the case, and we're not sure how much of it is due to the inexperience of the user and non-familiarity with the platform, and how much is actually, in fact, not really there. I suspect that there really isn't a lot there as far as descriptions and charts and math markup and that sort of thing yet. Is it coming? I sure hope so.
I think the important thing that I think about, though, is that I worry about what a text-to-speech screen reader is really going to be capable of as far as some charts. I remember having textbooks read by Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic, now Learning Ally. They were really complicated, and so I'm not really sure what textbook publishers are going to do to mitigate that issue. I'm sure that it can be done. I'm just not sure how it's going to work out.
And there's probably no real universal way to do it. I don't know. I guess right. We're just going to have to wait for the full page refreshable tactile display.
Speaking of education, let's talk about the education announcement, which we didn't cover last episode, and how we feel about it.
The first thing that I want to really address is there was a bit of a firestorm around Apple's original licensing agreement for the iBooks authoring tool, wherein it said something like, if you use this tool to create a book, you can give it away all you want, but if you sell it, you can only sell it on Apple iTunes, and if we reject it for whatever reason, too bad, so sad, you're out of luck, you can't sell it anywhere else. And so there was a bit of a firestorm around that. Well, good news is that Apple has backed off on that somewhat, and now they're saying that you can sell your work that's created with the iBooks authoring tool in any format except the iBooks format on other venues. iBooks format can only be sold through the iBooks store. So that's definitely an improvement.
I kind of think that they meant that all along.
They probably did.
I think that people misinterpreted their language there.
They probably did mean it all along, but it's good that they clarified it.
I think what the announcement said to me was that hopefully what we're going to see is more textbook producers turning to the iPad to make their books, which hopefully means that they will be more accessible to us voiceover users and Braille users. The other thing that I've heard is that the authoring tool is very simple and easy to use, which hopefully will be an inspiration for teachers. I think that the iPad is a really great tool that can be utilized in a classroom, and I think it's another multimedia platform for teachers to use to engage with their students. And I think that having the option as a teacher to put my curriculum in another format that will maybe better engage with my students is a really good thing and really positive.
Having a little bit of knowledge of the textbook publishing landscape and the players involved, as well as having taken a quick look at the authoring tool, I have a feeling that this isn't going to gain very much traction. And unfortunately, I think that the publishing houses are very much stuck in kind of the old guard way of producing books.
Well, textbooks in and of themselves are the old way of doing things. So,
right.
Yeah.
And right now, the people in charge of education are still supportive of that model.
Right.
So as unfortunate as it is, I don't see much happening as far as especially higher education textbooks changing. I hope that I'm wrong about that, but I don't think I am.
The other part of that education announcement was the new iTunes U app. This is now iTunes U used to be a part of iTunes that was specifically for higher education. It was podcasts and talks and lectures done by professors from all over the country. And now they've put it into an app, and the app actually has full courses. I myself have taken a course on volcanoes and another one on new energy, and those were both offered from the Open University out of the UK. And I also have one that's from TED.com. I've been very happy with the iTunes U app. It's very easy to use, and I think it's really a great tool that's open to everyone who has an iOS device. This is education for the world. It's not a US-only thing, and I think it could be a really great way to educate people in their own homes and in a way that hasn't been done before.
What I think is interesting is that we have an opportunity to get content that is traditionally only available in higher education. And for me, speaking as someone who went to university and didn't particularly find that a very rewarding process for me, being able to pick and choose a class that I wanted to take here or a class I wanted to take there and, you know, absorb the material without having to worry about tests or any of that, and just learning about something is neat and I think is beneficial to everyone.
At Stanford, they offered this AI course for free online. And within something like 24 hours, they had over 100,000 students from all over the world. And this particular situation has inspired that professor to leave his post at Stanford. And he's now going to dedicate his teaching to online education because of how popular and great the turnout was for this particular course. I think it's great for everyone involved, and I really hope that a lot of universities end up taking the time to put these courses together and offering them to people. So Peter kind of talked a little bit about the fact that he doesn't really see the new iBooks update with authoring tool end up changing the whole textbook situation, and the cost involved might pan out that that's really not what they're going to do.
I kind of wonder really how accurate that analysis is. I guess it probably is, but they forgot to take into account in their calculation, $75 per textbook, which they expect to use for 5 years. They forgot to take into account the things like, you know, students drawing in the textbooks and ripping out pages out of the textbooks and mutilating, stapling, bending, and folding the textbooks. And come on, you can't tell me this doesn't happen because I was in high school.
And to be clear, I don't in any way advocate the practices of the current publishing houses and the fact that we're kind of stuck in a pre-technology mindset with them. My argument would be that digital textbooks are a superior form of producing and distributing textbooks. But the unhappy reality is that you and I are not in charge of how this stuff happens right now.
Yep.
True.
So finally, on the sort of the education tangent, the Braille literacy situation that we have in this country and around the world, actually. So the NFB estimates that only about 12% of children are actually being taught how to read and write Braille. And technology kind of seems to be a good and bad thing when it comes to Braille. So we have two stories that look at two different ideas of how Braille is impacted by technology. One talks about how technology has decreased Braille literacy because a lot of teachers are not taking the time to teach it. And they're using screen readers and screen magnification and other technological devices to help their students read print rather than Braille. And the other one says, no, with the iOS devices, we actually are able to pair a Braille display and make Braille more user-friendly because they can pair it with their iPhone. And I think they're both right, honestly. And I really don't know what that means, because I think on the one hand, we really could increase Braille usage because of the iOS devices and because of other mainstream devices that can be paired with a Braille display. But Braille displays are still too expensive. And I think that's
the biggest problem right there.
The biggest problem that we face. Braille is too expensive to produce. It's too expensive to provide to our students. That doesn't mean that we should stop teaching it, because I really am of the opinion that any child who cannot read regular print that's magnified to a level that's going to be easy to produce should learn Braille. I fought it in high school because I was a print reader and I didn't really want to face the idea that I was going to lose my vision, but it did. And I'm grateful every single day that I have that option.
They are both right, but I think to blame iDevices in specific or portable cell phones and PDAs and things like that in general on the decline of Braille is simplistic at best.
And intellectually lazy at worst.
Yes.
Intellectually lazy at worst.
Yeah.
But yeah, this has been a problem that's been a problem for decades.
Right.
Decades, literally decades. And before it was talking computers, it was books on tape.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, hard copy Braille, the batteries don't die on.
Yep.
You know, I have some pretty strong opinions about Braille, and I've never been one to mince words. So if you find my opinion about this to be direct, it's because I feel strongly about it. Braille is an important skill for any blind person, and I believe that whether you read Braille once a week or once a year, that the fact that you know and understand how to read Braille is a skill that I can't express to you how important it is. Listening to a text-to-speech voice all day, while it's nice and convenient and in a lot of ways a lot faster than reading Braille can be at times, Braille provides you some important context. It provides you understanding of sentence structure. It provides you understanding of spelling. It provides you understanding of things that aren't going to be available to you electronically. Mm-hmm. Signs on doors. Something as simple as finding the restroom independently and not having to explain why you're in the opposite gender's bathroom. I just feel that it's a skill that we shouldn't be overlooking. We don't tell any sighted children that, hey, it's okay not to read because you've got these tools available to you to, you know, make it so you don't have to.
Yeah, these teachers that say, well, it's the student's choice. No, it is not the student's choice. It is
and,
the student
parents,
does not.
Parents, I encourage you to share a little bit of my backstory. Growing up, my parents had to fight, and they had to fight hard for me to learn Braille. They had to threaten my local school district with a lawsuit before the school eventually gave in and taught me Braille.
And Peter isn't alone.
Up until then, I was reading.
You're not alone.
Yeah, I was reading letters on the closed circuit television, and then my parents realized the words were getting too big for me to read them. I was reading a word and then sliding the book down and reading another word, and it wasn't a viable solution. And I am so grateful to my mom and dad for making them teach me Braille, because I think that it's made me a more effective person, a more effective professional.
And the reality of the situation is, unfortunately, we have a law that says that Braille should be taught unless there is compelling reasons not to. There's no specific standard across the board for states on what they require of their teachers of the blind. And that's, unfortunately, the reality we live in. I, myself, am studying to become a transcriptionist. Now, I'm choosing to do this, and I'm hoping to become a teacher myself. And I'm choosing to get that certification as a transcriptionist because I want to know that when I'm teaching my students how to learn Braille, that I'm teaching them from the perspective that I know all the rules and know they don't have to be perfect and know all the rules and get them right all the time, but they're going to know that their teacher knows what that is. And when you look at programs around the country that don't make Braille a priority, it's a little disconcerting to me.
Not every school district even has an established program. I mean, we didn't have one where I lived. So parents, I want to let you know that you do have a right to request that your child learn to read in the medium that is best for them. And in many, many, many cases, especially with any sort of significant vision loss, that is Braille. Do not be afraid to call your State Department of Education and the disability legal rights organizations in your state. And if your school district, your local school district, wants to play chicken with the state and their state funding, then tell them you'll see them in court.
That's our two cents. We'd love to hear from you guys.
There's nobody to debate us here.
That's right. We're preaching to the choir. But please, you know, give us your feedback on this. I think that the Braille literacy rate in this country is a really important issue that we as the blind community and friends of the blind community need to be really, really passionate about and make sure that when you see a child who needs to learn Braille and they're not learning Braille, then advocate for that child and see what you can do because they shouldn't have to go through life not knowing how to read because somebody decided, oh, well, you can read print. You just have to try harder. Buddy and Peter got the Aftershock headphones. And they're going to tell you their opinions of these fancy new headphones.
So as many of you know, these devices were announced right around the Consumer Electronics Show time. And a lot of people kind of skimmed over it, but they caught my attention because I'm a runner. So naturally, it would be nice to have some tunes while I'm seeing if I can explode my lungs. I don't usually listen to anything while I'm running because I am very reliant on my hearing to hear traffic patterns around me. I have a little bit of vision, but I don't like to rely on it completely since I would probably be a smashed smear in the road by now if I had done that. So these devices were particularly appealing to me. So I went ahead and ordered a pair as soon as Buddy had tweeted about having purchased some. And just recently got them and had a chance to put them through their paces. The one thing I will tell you is they work, but they have a couple of drawbacks that I consider to be pretty annoying. The first one is, and I didn't realize this when I bought them, these things actually need to be charged. They're not powered strictly by plugging them into your device, so they have a finite amount of operating time. So far, the battery life has been pretty decent. It's better than having the batteries die all the time, but that was a mild annoyance. The other thing that I find a little bit annoying about them is that they have put the battery in the middle of the device such that where the microphone and battery reside, it's a pretty hefty little part of the device. So adjusting the volume or taking a call or, you know, turning the device on and off, that control is integrated with the microphone and the battery compartment, and it makes that part of the cord heavy, and so subsequently you end up having to clip this to the top of your shirt or somewhere like that, so you know anybody might be able to hear you. So those are the things that I didn't like about them, but other than that, they actually do a very good job. They work as advertised. You can hear your music. You can hear voiceover talking to you while you're jogging or walking or doing whatever, and you can still hear your surroundings. The only other thing I really have to comment on is that they don't isolate sound very well. So if you're sitting next to someone on, say, a city bus, it's more than likely that they'll be able to hear what's going on in your headphones. But other than that, they work as advertised, and I'm reasonably satisfied with my purchase. Buddy?
I like mine. I'm definitely a fan. I mean, the things that Pete says about them are true, but they weren't deal breakers in the slightest for me. And you can actually get my whole huge long dissertation with Mike Calvo's huge long big dissertation about these on the latest Serotalk podcast, which is at serotalk.com.
So I can now proudly say that I have the iPhone 4S.
Yay!
We are now all iPhone 4S users. So I got my iPhone at the beginning of February. I was very excited because my upgrade was finally available.
And when are you going to do when the iPhone 5 comes out? Are you going to do what I do and just pay the full upgrade price?
No. I went from the 3GS to the 4S, so I'm in heaven. Wow.
So did I.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. And I will say...
So none of y'all are as crazy as I am?
Pretty much.
You're the crazy, Peter. I'm so happy with my iPhone 4S.
It's speedy,
fast. Siri is amazing. I love being able to dictate whole emails and text messages, and I set up appointments, and it's just so much easier and so much faster than my 3GS. I'm really, really pleased that I made the upgrade, and I would encourage anybody who has a 3GS, if you haven't made the jump and you want to make the jump to an iPhone 4, make the jump to the iPhone 4S. Siri is really worth the extra cost, in my opinion. As a voiceover user especially, it's amazing. I don't know, I just don't have words. I feel like I'm experiencing something I never even imagined, and it's so cool.
It's magical.
It is magical.
As Ricky would say.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and that's another thing I want to bring up while we're on the topic of hardware upgrades. You know, guys, when you get an upgrade chance, when you're eligible for an upgrade, don't try and save yourselves $100 by upgrading to the model that's in between yours and the newest one. First of all, when you go to sell your device, if you sell your device, if you're three versions behind instead of two versions behind, the amount of return you're going to get on that is minimal. And think about the life of your contract. You're paying AT&T or Verizon on an individual plan probably upwards of $70 or $80 a month. Over 2 years, that's a significant amount of money. Saving yourself $100 over that two-year period for the difference in features and at the rate at which these things iterate doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Peter, do you have anything special that you've put on the iPhone or any new feature that you want to talk to us about?
You know, I know that everyone thinks that I know all this fun stuff, but I'm actually pretty boring. I don't really have anything exciting to speak of. There is actually a new app that I've been using called Netmaster that lets you do some network analysis tools, some troubleshooting stuff, but not sure how useful that is to the average iPhone user.
I can tell you that I've been playing iFarkle Free and King's Corner, and I think I might be an addict.
I've only been playing Hanging with Friends.
All right.
So that one's actually fully accessible?
Yeah. Hanging with Friends is pretty accessible, yeah.
Huh. I thought it was just because it was by Words with Friends, I figured it wasn't, so I didn't even bother with it.
No, Hanging with Friends is cool.
Right, no, because Words with Friends is still not.
No, Hanging is cool, though. I haven't tried iFarkle yet. I've seen people refer to it. And
it's fun.
I also haven't done Domino Train yet, either.
Triple click palm.
So thanks all for listening to this episode of Triple Click Home. If you want to learn more about us, you should follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/tripleclickhome. You can also visit our website, tripleclickhome.com. You can subscribe to our podcast via iTunes and listen to it on iBlink Radio. I'm Alina Roberts, and you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/blindperspective. That's BLINDPERSPECTIV.
And I'm Peter Bosley, and I'm twitter.com/pbosley, PBOSSLEY.
And I'm Buddy Brannon. You can follow me at twitter.com/bbrannon. Aren't we exciting? It's twitter.com/BBRANNAN.
I think Alina has the most exciting Twitter name of all of
us. I think she does, yeah.
And I'd like to hear the story behind the missing E, too.
I think she just ran out of characters.
There's not enough characters.
There's a limit?
There is. There's a limit on number of characters for your username, so I ran out of characters.
I thought maybe, you know, the last Braille book you read didn't have an E on the end of the perspective, so you didn't know how to spell it.
Well, she could change it to BLP left bracket SPECTIVE. Sorry, Braille geek joke.
All right, anyway, thanks everybody for listening. We appreciate it. We'll see you next time.